Hello and welcome to a podcast recording for the September Insurance Contracts ISB sessions. My name is Andrea Pride, I'm the project leader, and with me is Daryl Scott, an ISB member. So we've had a particularly heavy set of discussions on the insurance contracts project this month, covering the interaction of the different effective dates of IFRS 9 and IFRS 4. We've also made some progress on the consequences of the variable fee approach for when an entity uses derivatives to mitigate risks. And also we've looked at the discussions around other comprehensive income, the use of other comprehensive income, and how you report an insurance investment expense in profit or loss. So let's take those one at a time, starting with the different effective dates of IFRS 9 and IFRS 4. This is obviously a particularly urgent discussion in view of the imminent arrival of IFRS 9. And so the board is moving quickly towards an exposure draft. Daryl, would you like to tell us a little bit about what this exposure draft is going to propose and some of the background behind it?
So I think the starting point in discussing this issue was that the board has in fact looked at this issue once before earlier this year in January. And at that stage, the board considered but concluded that an exemption for just insurers or a deferral for just insurers would be particularly difficult to achieve because of the difficulty that we have in defining what an insurer is. Subsequent to the meeting in January, we've had considerable feedback from the insurance industry on their concerns with the effect of applying IFRS 9. And essentially what the concern comes down to is that because of the time lag that is likely to occur between adopting IFRS 9 and the adoption of the new insurance project, there are likely to be two significant issues that arise. The first is a volatility issue, which is that the matching of insurance income under the old IFRS 4 and the associated assets under the new IFRS 9 results in a difference, or has the consequence of a different approach for assets and liabilities, which could be corrected under IFRS 4 as it stands at the moment, but would lead to a double change, requiring insurers to change their IFRS 4 accounting first in response to the adoption of IFRS 9 and later again in response to the adoption of the new IFRS 4. Insurers are concerned that if they don't make that change to their existing IFRS 4 accounting, IFRS 9 will lead to this volatility. If they do make that change to their their liability accounting, that will result in additional costs because of the two-step approach. So the board has considered that, and at our July meeting we considered one solution to this problem, which was termed the overlay approach. The overlay approach is essentially an approach which it allows insurers to adjust for that volatility in the income statement by fully adopting IFRS 9, but from an income statement perspective, removing the volatility from the income statement and putting it in OCI. In July, the board decided that that approach was a viable approach, and we voted to go ahead and make it happen. During the course of this meeting, the board refined some of the issues that they discussed in July and concluded that that approach should go ahead into an exposure draft. So that's the overlay approach. The second element of the discussion that the board had was about absolute deferral. The difficulty with absolute deferral is that the board is of the view that IFRS 9 provides real value as an approach going forward. We feel that companies should be applying IFRS 9 in full. And so the consideration for the board when thinking about the deferral of IFRS 9 for particular companies is a very stringent need to limit the application to a very small group of companies or of reporting entities.
So that was particularly borne out, I think, the board, when it made its decision, was particularly bearing in mind the feedback we had from users of financial statements on that, and on what we had heard there about was that even though IFRS 9 was seen slightly differently by preparers of insurance companies' financial statements, the users were very much aware that IFRS 9 existed and wanted to have some information about IFRS 9.
So I think taking account of that user feedback, taking account also obviously of the preparer feedback that had got us into this discussion in the first place, the board, by a relatively narrow vote, agreed that we would propose a deferral approach, But to take account of the user views, we would define it for a very narrow group of companies that were predominantly engaged in insurance activities. And that allowed us to say that although we still believe there's a downside to a deferral approach, at least we are restricting that downside to this very small group. The board then had to decide whether we would propose in the exposure draft both of these approaches that we've talked about, the overlay approach and the deferral approach. As I've mentioned, under the deferral approach, there was a very narrow scope. Because the overlay approach actually requires the full adoption of IFRS 9 and consequently allows for the full benefits to be transparently disclosed in the financial statements of a company, the board was much more comfortable that the scope of that overlay approach could be much broader. Consequently, in thinking about choosing between one or the other or both, the board concluded that we would be comfortable actually proposing both approaches, with a view that deferral could be applied by a very narrow group, but if these issues, particularly the volatility issue, were apparent or were a problem for a broader group, they had the overlay approach which would allow them to solve for that one.
Another thing that many board members felt quite strongly about was whether the deferral approach in particular would be allowed to be open-ended in view of the uncertainty that had been surrounding the timing of the new insurance contract standard. So I think we're expecting to finish deliberations on the main insurance contract standard in the last part of this year. Some board members in particular were very uncomfortable with the idea that should something cause a delay to that timetable, that the deferral approach might go longer than the short time, which had been a major part of their considerations in allowing for a deferral approach in the first place.
That's correct. I think the board is clearly committed to finishing the insurance project on a time-years basis. Nonetheless, it is a project that we are still busy with. It is still an open project, and the timing of open projects isn't always absolutely determinable. So essentially what the board decided is, while we're comfortable, for the reasons mentioned before, for the overlay approach to continue for an extended period, we felt that the deferral approach should not, because you were losing the advantages of applying full IFRS 9. So what the board has essentially said is that the deferral approach will start from the commencement date of IFRS 9, whenever that might be for an entity. Well, effectively 2018, actually, the effective date of IFRS 9, but will cease to be applicable from 2021, and that's a mandatory cessation. At that point in time, an entity will be able to elect to then go fully live on IFRS 9, or alternatively to adopt the overlay approach going forward and get the advantages that the overlay approach provides without actually avoiding using IFRS 9.
And because both of these approaches would be proposed in an amendment to IFRS 4, what that means is that when the new insurance contract standard comes into force, then both of them disappear, and ultimately entities will be applying the new insurance contract standard with IFRS 9 in full.
And I think that's really important. I think these are not built in any way to the IFRS 9 approach. They are purely an IFRS 4 approach, because they are only, for both of them, applicable to entities that currently apply IFRS 4. They are proposed and will be exposed as a single package of adjustments that we make to IFRS 4, and we would look to our constituents to look at them as a single package and to comment on both parts of this package.
Thank you. So let's turn our attention now to the main insurance contracts project. So over the last year, we've spent a considerable amount of time discussing the accounting model for contracts that have participation features, and in particular, the variable fee approach, which the ISB voted to have in just before the summer. We've now started looking at the consequences of the variable fee approach and in examining some of the issues that might arise around that. And the topic for this month was on what happens when you apply a variable fee approach, but the entity also buys, say, a derivative to mitigate the risks, for example, interest rate risk, and then as a result suffers an accounting mismatch, whether that's a problem that the ISB thought that we should provide some sort of approach to deal with.
In discussing this, the board was very aware of the fact that insurance companies do from time to time undertake risk mitigation activities. These activities will result potentially in a mismatch in the accounting, because of the nature of accounting for a derivative versus the nature of accounting for the variable fee. So what the board agreed to, which was the staff proposal, was that in certain circumstances and subject to certain criteria, a reporting entity could choose to report the changes in the valuation of its guarantee through profit or loss. Now that approach is consistent with the approach for the general model, so essentially what the board is proposing is that under certain circumstances the requirements of the variable fee approach are relaxed for guarantees, such that essentially for guarantees you achieve a general model accounting approach. We've borrowed to a certain extent from the hedging criteria in IFRS 9 for us to set the criteria under which you can apply this approach. That by no manner of means this is hedging. Simply what it's done is it's allowed us to set the entry criteria and the exit criteria in a manner that is consistent with that applied under the hedging approach. And that will allow us to provide a little bit of a rigor about when you can commence this type of accounting, and again at the end of the process when you can stop this type of accounting approach.
And then the last topic on the fourth day was to do with the presentation of investment interest expense. And this is a topic that the board has discussed in a lot of detail over the last year, a lot of mechanical detail with a lot of examples. And it's fair to say, I think, that many board members find this is a tricky topic to get their heads around. So what we did at this meeting was to try to take a step back and sort of articulate what the objective of what we're trying to do by having investment expense to match against investment income from assets, and to try and express that in a more principles-based way, if you like.
Yeah, I think the difficulty that the board has experienced in trying to define OCI for the purposes of both general model and variable fees is that very few, that there are many different methods or very many different approaches that companies have used for the design of insurance products. And it's become particularly difficult for the board to actually define how and which approaches apply in which circumstances, so that you can decide how to use OCI for each of the different product types. What the board decided in the meeting, firstly, as a primary governor for all of our OCI decisions that follow, is that OCI is a choice. It's an accounting policy choice. An entity has always got the choice to go for a current method through profit and loss. Should an entity choose to apply OCI, however, what we've agreed is that the objective of OCI is that you should achieve a cost-based measurement basis. And what that essentially means, what cost essentially means in this case, is that you need to be releasing income from OCI on a systematic basis over the life of the contract. We have chosen very specifically then not to define the exact mechanics of how an entity would achieve that. And as I say, we've done that because there are just too many different product types, we believe, out there. The accounting would become essentially too rules-based. What the board did request staff to do is to consider whether we should put guidance in with examples about different methods that you could use in this space and how those different methods would achieve this objective. So essentially setting the objective up front and then giving an idea to users or to preparers how they can achieve that objective over the period of time. That's the first step, and that essentially covers all products except, and there is an exception to the process. The exception is for those circumstances where a reporting entity exactly matches assets with liabilities. So you have a one-to-one matching between the underlying asset portfolio and the liability portfolio. In that circumstance, if an entity has elected to apply OCI, then it applies a very special type of OCI, which we've called current book yield approach. The current book yield approach essentially says that the OCI application to the liability income statement moves must be identical to the OCI application to the asset book. What that allows us to do is achieve perfect matching. Essentially, it reflects the fact that the board believes that when there are exactly the same assets matching the liabilities, there is no possibility for economic mismatch. And consequently, but we believe that this accounting would best achieve no accounting mismatch to offset the fact that there is no economic mismatch. The board has said that because of that fact, we think that if you are in the situation where your assets match your liabilities, in other words, you are in the circumstance where there's no possibility of an economic mismatch, and you have chosen to use OCI, you must use this method because it achieves the perfect accounting match.
Okay, so that was a fairly heavy board agenda, and it was totalling, I think, about 8 hours of board time in total. So the next steps are to look forward to the October board meeting, where we'll be hoping to conclude some more of the items that are left outstanding. In terms of documents to be published, our expectation is that we would be publishing an exposure draft of the amendments to IFRS 4 to deal with the different expected dates in the last part of this year, and we would also be aiming to finalise deliberations on the main insurance contracts project in the last part of this year. So I think there's a busy few months for us still to go. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this podcast.
Thank you.